Interviewed by Susan Cuffell, January 11, 1979. Dr. Dickman, you were born at a place in the world at a time that was historically very important. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Tukum, a small town in Latvia. Latvia was at the time under the rule of the Tsar of Russia. It was 1905, July 4th. My father was a teacher and he was also an organist. And since high school, I graduated from the high school in my native town, Tukum. Then I went to Riga, to Polytechnical Institute. But as I didn't like commercial science, I went to Petrograd and studied in Psychoneurological Institute. Since I could not finish it because the war was going on, and had to go into military service. And then after that, I studied in Latvian University. This has its chief things regarding education. But I must say, all these high seeds of learning are materialistic. They have their purpose. They make the easier life after one graduates from some. One gets easier a job, easier an employment, much more salaries. That is all good from the materialistic point of view. But the man is not only matter. And he is not simply also an animal. The most important part of human being is the spirit. But the spirit can be so completely drowned into matter that we do not think much about the spirit. But that is all our real self. And the universities and the college do not say as much. Practically, they do not say anything about our spirit. And they do not help us to realize the spirit. They do not help us to realize our real self. They say only with great aplomb, to know the self is the highest knowledge. Socrates said this. But what it really means, they really do not teach, and they cannot teach because they themselves do not know. So it is, for instance, known formally in Russia at the time of the Tsar that a real man who wants to know God cannot learn it from the priest. Even the priest himself said so. They say, you must go to a starets. That means something like a monk. Who knows God? They can teach. And the same thing is also the tradition in India. If one wants to know God, then they say, you must go to a man who himself has realized God. A priest cannot teach, provided he is himself a man of realization, a man who has seen God. Otherwise, the priest is a man who performs wedding and all other ceremonies. And the people do not expect anything more from him. Is there a wedding, is a childbirth, they call a priest and they know the priest knows the ceremonies and he does, and he is like an official. So, but I was happy. I got in the form of my godfather, a man who had seen God and who could make also other people to see. And that happened this way. He was by profession a seaman, a good man by heart, but a very joyful and so. But at that time, he transported goods from one country to another by boats, not by steam, but by sailboats. And when he was on the near the Scandinavian countries, there was a heavy storm, and the captain said, "There is a last time for us. Who knows? Let him pray." And so the sailors started praying to God, and happened a miracle. The storm did not subside completely, but it became very calm in the place where the boat was. And the wind changed in favor of them, and they came out on the Scandinavian border. So my godfather sold the boat. He said, "I will never step more on a boat." And he became very, very religious. And it happened one evening when he wrote in the Bible, and it was again occasioned by that case, because my father was doubtful whether he really has seen God, because in the Old Testament it said nobody has seen God. But he guesses this, so my father never expresses his doubt, but he guessed it. And so he opened St. John's chapter 14 and said, "We should read it." So we read it. At the end he said, "Now what, did you find something interesting, something special?" And my father could not say anything. He said, "Then read the second time." And I was also present. I became very much interested because I was a young man, a schoolboy at the time. Again, nothing special. Then finally he put his finger on the 14th verse and said, "Read this." And there was said that one who loves God and who abides by his laws, to him he appears. Now, Father, the Godfather asked my father, "Now, uncle, do you believe that I have seen God?" Then father said, "Yes." And then he said, "Do you want also see God?" My father said, "Yes." Then I was sent to another room, and I went to another room, and he prayed that God should appear to him in the dream. Next morning, he did not ask, "Did you see God?" But he said, "Tell me, please, how did you see him?" And my father, my father had a wonderful vision of God. So I saw here is not what the church generally say, we must believe, we must believe. I found there is something definite in religion if we really take religion. Secondly, we find it is quite enough if we go once in a week to church. But in his case, the name of God was constantly on his lips. And when he started thinking or speaking on God, tears came from his eyes. And that is what Ramakrishna, a great Indian saint, said. That is the characteristic of a man of God. So I saw that religion is not simply belief, simply blind belief, but there is something great in it.
That's a fascinating story. And I can see how it shaped your early faith. Where did your spiritual quest take you? After you'd had this experience of living with your godfather and having an awareness of what God meant to him, how did that affect your later spiritual quest?
Yeah, then I went to Psychoneurological Institute, and we had to study hypnology. So this is science of suggestion and hypnosis. And I read there one was a good translation into Russian from an, maybe it was a French book, but written by an Indian scholar about Indian hypnotism. And then I became interested in hypnosis. And again, surprised me the so-called post-hypnotic suggestion, because we were taught in the church that man has free will. And when one puts a strange post-hypnotic suggestion, a man that works like an automaton, not a man of free will. Then the question came to me whether there is free will or not. And then in that book was also said much about yoga. And then I wanted to know what really yoga is. At that time there was very much involved the theosophy. And I read the theosophical books, but I had doubts whether I have interpreted yoga and the Hindu teachings correctly. So I learned some of the Indian language so that I could read the original texts. And I was surprised, or rather happy, that I read the original text, because it was not the theosophy, did not exactly interpret. So I were in sympathy with the Hindu teachings, but I still did not interpret them correctly. So I started reading or subscribing and studying the original texts, and wherever I could make, I tried to get contact with the Swamis, with the yogis, and I was happy I got contact with some of the greatest yogis in India.
Can you tell us some of their names, Dr. Dickman?
Excuse me?
Can you tell us some of their names?
Yeah. Could you stop there a little bit?
Sure. Who were some of these Indian religious leaders that you wrote to and that you read?
First impressed me Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna was, of course, had passed away. Then I read his disciples, Vivekananda and Abhedananda. And Vivekananda impressed me by his freedom, because I said religion is always impressed in a strong limits. And I abided by those limits, and I became more or less a fanatic. But here I saw in Vivekananda's writings that religion is not based on fear. Even what more, Vivekananda said, where there is fear, there is no love. And in our catechism, it is said always, we must fear God and love God. But Vivekananda explained that it's impossibility. The moment we have a fear, we don't have a love. And if we have love, there is no fear anymore. So I was impressed that one can be in religion also very free, very fearless. And that impressed me. Then one should never, that one should not fear dogmas. One should be free from dogmas. That was, but finally, I came after Vivekananda and Abhedananda, I came in contact with Ramana Maharshi, a great sage of India who was living at that time. Now it is long time he had passed away. And then of some others also teachers of India, but they were mostly Vedantins. That means the followers of the philosopher of Shankaracharya. who taught the Advaita Vedanta, that means monistic philosophy, that there is only one reality, and the reality is God, and the universe is more or less an illusion. Now that, everything appealed to me in this philosophy, except that how could I regard that this world is an illusion? Then I started more Patanjali's philosophy, which is more based on Sankhya. And Sankhya is a realistic philosophy, but it is not monistic, it is dualistic. But that does not bother me. Then I was interested in yoga.
Go ahead.
But yoga is more practical. Vedanta is more philosophy. And then I needed to get some real teacher who is yogi, not Vedantin. And then that I got in the person of Paramahamsa Yogananda. And really, I must say, the highest and the most impressive teachings or interesting teachings on higher spiritual teachings as regards yoga, I got from Yogananda. And I am really surprised sometimes, people who are interested in yoga and philosophy, and yoga's philosophy, they did not make the opportunity, because here was one of the greatest really spiritual teachers, and living in America and living for a long time, for many years, and people did not make the opportunity to see him and to speak with him. Well, anyway, I made, or rather he made the proposal that I come to the United States, study with him for 1 year, and he would want to send me to Ranchi, India, as a teacher. Unfortunately, when I came to United States, I sent only one letter to him and got one from him, and he passed away before I could see him. Later on, I of course visited the place where he is interred, or rather in a mausoleum, his body is prepared, and he saw the great centers in California, Los Angeles, and other places. He made impression in this sense, that he gave very practical instructions on yoga. And from now, what is the most important thing which might be of interest to you? As I said already, the idea of free will was one which interested me. And as I said, when I studied hypnosis, I lost faith in the free will, because when I saw the phenomena of post-hypnotic suggestion, as I asked myself, where is here the free will when the man acts like an automaton or not the man of free will? But then the question, every religion, of course, postulates the doctrine that man has a free will. For otherwise, how can he be punished for his sins if he has no free will? But that is another thing. That does not solve the problem at all. It is only the expression of an opinion. Then I asked why a man is acting like an automaton. Now we see practically automatons all over. We meet them every day on the street. Even people with the highest education behave mostly as an automaton. That is, when he takes a cigarette and smokes, when he drinks alcoholic drinks, every educated person knows that alcohol is poison. that it attacks the heart, the liver, the spleen, every vital organ is damaged by alcohol. Still, he drinks. But more dangerous than alcohol is smoking. And every educated person, professor of university, doctors and lawyers, all smoke. They are addicted to habit. So they are not free. Why is a man becomes a slave of his habits? That is very much interesting subject, and I found it explained in the sutras of Patanjali. Why? But Yogananda said even something much more. He said it depends upon the life force. Patanjali says that whether one is free or not free depends upon the subconscious mind, which is the same teachings which we have in our modern psychology or in our psychiatry. But the question of the life force is something different, because our science practically does not know life force. They say of a force of life, and that is regarded as a result of chemical reactions. But the life force, or prana shakti, which yogis speak, is something still different. But without going deep into the difference, let us say it better from practical point, how it works. The mind is dependent on this life force, say even the Indian Upanishads. And there is a story, I think it is Chandogya Upanishad, where one student wanted to learn also something about the nature of the life force, and the teacher said, well, go on fast for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, his mind was quite different, was very calm. So somehow he learned that the mind is dependent greatly on the life force. There is another story also in the Upanishads that all these senses and man came and asked each other, and asked, who is the highest of them? And so every disappeared sight, disappeared hearing, and then they came back and said, how? He says, everything was the same thing except I could not see. Everything was the same, only I could not hear. Then finally, life was said also, oh, okay, now is my time. I will go there. You know that the hearing could hear, neither seeing could see, and even the mind could not think. So the yogis say the thing is, if we want to get control over the mind, we must first get control over the life force. And here starts the most important, the training, which is called pranayama, the control over this life force. And this is very much stressed in this system of Paramahamsa Yogananda. It is called Kriya Yoga. Now the word Kriya Yoga does not explain much. Kriya means simply action. It should be really called Prana Kriya, the Kriya or the action of the life force. And that is the central point in this system. And to learn this system, I generally came to United States. That was my. I did not come for the American dollars, and I have no as much interest for it even today. But I came to learn this science of controlling the prana, the control of life force. Unfortunately, as I said, as I came to United States, at that time, after a few days, as I have arrived, Paramahamsa Yogananda passed away.
Did you continue with your work in pranayam?
Yeah.
Did you continue that after Yogananda passed away in
New York? I continued because I came in contact and with two of his disciples, rather three disciples, but two Indian and one American. American was Dr. Lewis, who was the first disciple of Yogananda here in the United States, and then with Swami Satchitananda Giri in India and Swami Satyananda Giri, also in India. Satyananda passed away. Satchitananda is still living.
Your spirituality is a mixture of Lutheranism from an early age, a lot of Eastern philosophy, and also some Islamic philosophy too. Is that not correct?
It is true, but as regards spirituality, I learned more from the Eastern than from the Western. Here I want to say one thing. For instance, I was very much interested in psychology, and I was interested also in psychiatry. And I was myself even a teacher of psychology in Germany in a high school. But still, I must say, probably I did not do an honest job, because I had to teach psychology, and I was especially advised not to speak about Oriental psychology, but of Western psychology. Now, what is Western psychology? It says, now what means logic? Means science. It is, so psychology is a science of psyche. But the psychology, the science of psychology, does not know the psyche. I remember even a lecture of professor of psychology in Latvian University. And he said, I am a psychologist, but I do not know what the psyche is. So that would be like a chemist would say, I will speak and teach you chemistry, but I don't know any chemical element. And the same thing, so you see, so therefore I was interested more in Indian psychology, because I said there is a psyche. And in, to some extent, the great American psychologist William James said also there is a soul. A soul independent of the body. But it is no wonder, because William James had great respect from Swami Vivekananda, who was in the United States teaching Vedanta. And in one book, he had even written that he has great devotion, and he regarded Vivekananda as his teacher. Now, if he regards Vivekananda as his teacher, how could he not accept his soul? Because this is central the teachings of Swami Vivekananda. So, again, the question comes, how to realize the soul? Now, the church says we should believe in it. But the scientists say, not. I want to experiment it. And yoga is a science of experimental psychology. especially that branch of yoga, which is called Raj Yoga. And it is interesting that Patanjali gives even very clear way how to realize. He first gives the definition of what is yoga. He said yoga chitta vritti nirodha. That means yoga is a cessation or stoppage of the mental vibrations. And then he said further, tada drashtuk sarva vasanam. That means then the seer rests in its native state. That means then the soul knows who it is. And then he said in the next sutra, he said, vritti sarupyam itaratra. That means, but at other times, that means the times when the mind works, when the mind goes into modifications, when the mind goes, assumes the forms of thoughts, it identifies itself with the thoughts which go in the mind at that moment. So we are always identification of ourselves with something else which is not ourselves. With those vrittis, with those modifications which are at present in our mind. You know, I get a pain in my body. I say, I am so sick. I feel pain. Next time, I am happy. I say, I am happy. Next time, I am not happy. I am sorrowful. I am sorry. I am sorrowful. So I have become, sometimes I was a body, sometimes I was a mind, sometimes I was happy mind, sometimes really, if we look deep within, the real self does not change. What changed is the mind changed. In the mind identifies himself with everything except the real self. So therefore, when Socrates says that the greatest wisdom is to know the self, he did not think that I must think whether I am good or bad, whether I have good memory, bad memory, whether I have good inclinations, bad inclinations. No. The real self in all is the same. That is a static point which does not change and around which go all the changes. And this is the knowledge what Socrates said, that we must know the self. The same thing is also in the Gita said, in the Bhagavad Gita, that one should know the self. And that is also the teachings of the Vedanta and all the great Indian Sankhya, all the great Indian philosophies. And that can be done in a scientific way. It can be done by stopping the vrittis or the modifications of the mind, as Patanjali teaches in his Raja Yoga, or by doing Kriya Yoga, getting control over the life force, as Paramahamsa Yogananda teaches. Now here I will say a little more. For instance, Yogananda himself demonstrated before the King of England that he can stop completely the heart. And he said that if the doctors or medical doctors are interested, he will stop the heart for 3 days and 3 nights. Unfortunately, nobody had the interest to see it. And now, in his system is this, that you get control over the life force. If you get control over the life force, you get control over all organs, including the heart. You can stop the heart and you can make the heart beat again. Now here it is something interesting. It is means that you get control over the death, because you can die at will and can revive at will. Then you know, if you do this, then you know that you are not the body, that you are something higher, that you are higher, that you are even the master of your life force. Even life and death is under your control. This is Kriya Yoga and this which Yogananda taught. Then we need not believe in dogmas. because we can experience the same thing. And that was what St. Paul said, I die daily. And the yogis, who, when they read this statement, they said, oh, he knew yoga. He knew how to stop the heart. He knew how to revive it. And this is both the Kriya Yoga and Patanjali's Yoga, which give a definite method and a practical method how we can realize who we really are. We can realize that we are the immortal soul. Only the methods are different. Patanjali goes through the control of the modifications of the mind, which we have to stop. And Paramahamsa Yogananda says we can, we must have got control over our life so that we can die at will and can revive at will. And that is, the methods are different, but the aim is the same in both cases.
That's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. I wanted to ask you too about how you feel your early life was shaped by the brutality of the events in Europe and man's inhumanity to man. How is that a backdrop for and a counterpoint to your religious evolvement? Do you see a connection? Can you talk about that?
As I said already, I was a little bit fanatic. Even so, I was born in a Lutheran atmosphere, which is rather liberal. But still, dogmatism is there. And we have still some dogmas. When I came more, as I said already, with Vivekananda, I was surprised about his free ideas in religion, and this certainly influenced me. I was a little scared at some because how can a man really think so freely about those things which dogmas rather have made limitations? And then I had, as I said, also the experience with my godfather when I saw, I will give some explanation. As he became very religious, he developed, without trying to develop, some insights which we ordinarily do not have. For instance, he visited us once in Tukum, and we had a few guests, and he said he must go back to his place in Dondangan. And I accompanied him to the doors with my father, and then suddenly he turned back and he said, remember, uncle, this fall you will see blood on the streets of Tukum. It was springtime. And then he left. My father came back to the guests and said, strange, with Uncle Leonidas, he says that we will see in the fall blood on the street of Tukum. Will there be a war? What will be? We have no bad conditions, connections with England. We have no bad connections with Germany. Where can there war be? It was not war, it was revolution. And it was a strong revolution. And they were shot down the horses and some soldiers. And I was at the time on the railway station, and I came back as there was a truce, and I saw really the shot horses on the street, and blood, really literally blood I saw on the street. Now, then after the revolution had passed.
Excuse me, Dr. Dickman, was this the Russian Revolution that had its effect in Latvia?
Yeah, but Latvia was at the time under the rule of the Tsar, so it was, we can say, the Russian Revolution. Now, in Russia, the revolution was against the Tsar, But in the Baltic states, it wasn't a revolution. It was the same revolution, but we were more against the German barons. And nobody thought about the Tsar. The Tsar was not in our interest. It was, but the socialists who made the revolution, they used the interest and said, you are against the barons, but the idea was of the socialists was, of course, to against the Tsar, not against, but we in the Baltic states were trusting, we are getting rid of the barons.
In other words, you were aligning with the Tsar against the German barons.
Huh?
You were aligning with the Tsar against the barons, the German barons?
No, the Tsar was not against the barons.
Oh.
The Tsar protected rather the barons. But our interests were not against the Tsar. Our interests were first against the German barons.
I understand. In the event of the overthrow of the Tsar, if the Tsar were overthrown, then also would the German barons be?
That is a question. We could not know how it would have been. Mm-hmm. Depends what form it would take and so on.
I see. Go on.
Yeah.
Go on.
Then again, we met, said my godfather came and visited us, and my father asked him, he said, now the troubles about which you foresaw are over. He smiled, he said, no, he said, much more will be in, and then started the First World War. Now the First World War was over. Then again, he came to us, visited us, and my father again put the same question. Now, the great troubles which you foresaw and about whom are over. He said, no, much more greater will be. He said, but I will not see them, and you will not see them. And then he thought, he said, the eldest son may see it, may not see. But he said to me and to my youngest brothers, yes, I will see it. And that was the revolution which came after that. So when it's really religious man, he sees more than ordinary man.
What was your life like between World War I and World War II?
World War II. I think it was a time. Oh no! In World War First, I was military officer.
Yes. Want to talk a little bit about that?
No, I was. I cannot say anything bad. Really, the military service was successful in my case. So I was never tried to be an officer, but I had to be because. It was strange. In the psychological institute, as I said, if we were in the, you know, had to go to military service, there you can be so-called, I don't remember the name, uchoni sanitar, that means scholarly or nurse. And my eldest brother, who was a captain, he says, that is all nonsense. I have been in the military. I am in the military. He said, I never have seen such a person. In the... He says, it is all nonsense. He said, you must go to the military school, become an officer. Otherwise, he said, to be an ordinary soldier, you know, in Russian army, it was very bad. It was not regarded real, like a dog. So I went to Kiev, graduated from the military school. Then I went, and then I made a trick. I really do not make much tricks, but I made. I thought I will first see Austria. But my real idea was to serve in the Latvian regiments, But so I did not say this from the beginning. So I was first in Samara, in service, and I was in... and finally, when it came near to send to the front, then I wrote petition to the Tsar that I want in Zelaya.